actually going to go back in time to one of my favorite years in movies. This is the year that I saw Ghostbusters in the movie theater, and I freaked out within the first, I think, 5 minutes of it when the librarian ghost did that big scary reveal and became a skeleton jumping right out at us in the screen. And I think I cried. But about 2 minutes later, I was fine because I was at that age where we're totally pliant and able to, you know, rebound from trauma.
Mm-hmm. You think you cried or did you cry?
I definitely it's okay. I definitely cried. But, yeah. Because yeah, it's 1984. Be and I was a tiny tot in 1984.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you see it in the theater?
Well, Ghostbusters?
Yeah.
I've still never seen the entirety of Ghostbusters.
Oh, wow. I definitely didn't see it in the theater.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I had very permissive parents, I guess. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I guess my parents were the terrorists that take toddlers into movie theaters.
Yeah, they were like, we're seeing this movie.
You were what, like six?
Good luck, Gabe.
1984, I was 5 years old. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And you may hear, by the way, this is Gabe Pacheco, and you're listening to another episode, obviously, of Eat, Pray, Judge. And as always, my co-host is here.
Sammy Amarne.
And you may have heard a third voice on mic today, and that's because we're joined in the Greenpoint bunker by a good friend, Joanna Simmons.
Hello.
Yeah, so you'll be hearing more of Joanna's voice today. And as our guest, Joanna's picked the movie that we will be covering a little bit later on in the podcast. And that movie is 1984's Purple Rain.
Mm-hmm.
Super cool. But Joanna, where were you in 1984?
I was a 1 year old and I was living in England.
What?
Yeah. So I was actually born there. So I was not going to see Purple Rain in the movie theater or anything at that age.
Sure. So, this is a interesting fact about England in 1984. That was the year that Margaret Thatcher became prime minister. Mm-hmm. So I don't know
the Iron Lady.
yeah, she had that hairdo and that hatred of poor people, uh-huh, unions, and government services.
Yeah, my first words were Margaret Thatcher.
Yeah. So when did you come to the U.S. then?
When I was five.
When you were five.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And where did your family land?
Minneapolis.
What?
Wow.
Purple Rain.
Wow. So
topical.
We're connecting, mm-hmm, all the dots here. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Margaret Thatcher was ruling with an iron fist in England at this time. Ronald Reagan won his second term as president. And I remember this because this was the first election I remember. And my parents rooted for Mondale. So he went down in flames. And it was the first time I think I saw my parents as fallible. Because they bet on a losing horse, you know?
You picked up on that then? That's good.
Sure. Very. I looked at them and I was like, they're flawed. We're all...
He did get swept, basically. I don't think he won a state.
No. But he did break ground because his vice presidential running mate was Geraldine Ferraro.
First lady.
First woman to run for a vice president.
Not the last, though.
Not the last. And now we've got the HBO show Veep that you can watch if you want to see what it would be like if, mm-hmm, a woman was vice president.
It hilarious would be show hilarious.
I know. I love that show.
It's good.
Season is so dark.
It's damn, yeah, good.
Yeah. You got any pop trivia for us for 84?
Pop trivia? No, it was kind of a downer.
Yeah.
84. Marvin Gaye was shot to death by his dad.
In Washington, D.C.
He was actually shot in L.A., but he's from Washington, D.C.
That's okay, yeah, a native son.
A native son from our hometown. DNA fingerprinting was introduced.
Sure, so before that, people were just, like, biting other people.
Just going off of leads.
Yeah, just murdering willy-nilly without worrying about leaving any, like, traces of your own body behind.
Yeah, other big movies that came out, Beverly Hills Cop, Indiana Jones and Temple of Doom. Like a Virgin was the top song, Madonna.
Karate Kid.
Oh, yeah, there's a ton of a ton of 84 films.
That's the other film that I was watching nonstop in 1984. I didn't even think about Purple Rain. I was just totally focused on getting those little karate slip-ons.
Mm-hmm.
And my brother and I both got gis, pajamas that look like karate gis.
Mm-hmm.
Shipped to the house, and I had a white one, and my brother had a red one, and we would spar in the living room every day and break a different item of furniture in the house.
Nice.
Mm-hmm.
Not on purpose, but these things happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So, that takes us through sort of the context of this time, and now we're going to get to this movie, dude. Purple Rain. Is it blue? Is it red? Is it male? Is it female? Is it love? Is it hate? What's going on? It's the synthesis of all of these things. It's purple.
Yeah, it's confusing.
It is ambiguous, androgynous.
Just like Prince. It's Prince in a movie. It's like Prince's aura in a film.
Yeah. Okay. I didn't see Purple Rain when it came out at all. I saw it for the first time on the big screen, which I think was great. I saw like a remaster of it a couple of years ago, and I was so surprised. there's like three crazy things about it, and one was that it's what sold me on Prince as a live artist. I was just so blown away. And then the second thing was just the really uncomfortable gender dynamics for as much of a trailblazer as Prince was.
Yeah, there was also,
yep. The women in that film are not treated well, and even put in a dumpster.
Objectified, thrown in a dumpster, slapped.
Yeah.
It's pretty...
Yeah.
Pretty...
This movie is both...
tough.
Glossy, cartoonish, and really glammy.
Yeah.
It's very glam on one level, but then it's also gritty, which I think goes back to this sort of like... ambivalent dichotomy that's happening in it, and on one end it's like this fantasy about performing and being in the spotlight, but then there's also this underside with like crazy domestic, like so many serious issues, domestic mm-hmm. violence, suicide, alcoholism, spousal abuse,
right? Suicide. I guess his dad, Prince's dad in the film shot himself, but I don't think he successfully took his own life.
That's right. Attempted suicide.
Yeah, he gave himself a head wound by missing.
Which feels almost worse if you survive a suicide attempt where you shoot yourself in the head.
Just another failure to chalk up.
Oh, my God. And you're like, I don't know if you ever recover from that. I mean, you're alive, but you've taken out like a lot of your hard drive.
Sure.
You know?
It's like pouring water on your keyboard.
Wow. Sad. So when you saw this, what drew you to this film, though?
I think someone had an extra ticket, and and I was like, why not? And up until then, the only thing I really knew about Prince was that I had seen the Super Bowl performance in 2007, which was unreal. Like, it was pouring with rain, and he played a mashup that ended with Purple Rain.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it was just hands down the best Super Bowl.
Yeah.
Music performance ever, like maybe one of the only times I've actually seen someone play music at the halftime show and not just kind of like karaoke their own song. That's a I made a real wide statement there.
Yeah, well, I heard about that, and because I don't think I saw that performance, but I was watching a documentary on Prince, and they said that was the best. It's seen by the experts, the Super Bowl historians, as the greatest performance ever at a Super Bowl.
I mean, it started raining while he played, as soon as he started playing Purple Rain, which is kind of incredible.
Right.
Yeah.
That's like when like a dove lands on Bernie.
Yeah.
And you're like, what? Like, what serendipitous thing is this?
It's like when doves cry.
Yeah.
On Bernie's shoulder.
And then also there's the Minneapolis connection. I've always felt an affinity for Prince just because of Minneapolis. And then watching the movie was so cool because it's all shot there.
Yeah, the whole thing, huh?
Yeah, so like First Ave, I saw Silverchair at First Ave,
okay,
which is the club where he plays.
So you've actually been in First Ave?
Oh yeah.
Wow, and I didn't know if that was a real place or not.
Yeah, it's like the premier concert venue that's not a stadium situation. But huge bands play there, even though it's pretty small.
It's like 9:30.
Okay.
The 9:30 of Minneapolis.
Sure. 9:30 Club is D.C., like the big D.C. club. Mm-hmm. But so Minneapolis, and this is cool because he's such a regional artist, and I love artists that are identified with where they're from. So like John Waters in Baltimore, yes. Or like George Romero in Pittsburgh, and then you've got Prince in Minneapolis. And like even the music that he made and all of the bands that came out of Minneapolis that were affiliated with him, it's called the Minneapolis Sound,
yeah,
mm-hmm.
which is so cool.
It's like a sound that he cultivated.
Yeah. And,
completely.
And he is the father of all of these artists too. Like when you look at the other bands that are in the movie, The Time and Apollonia 6, which was at one point Vanity 6, he wrote all of their music. Mm-hmm. And there's all these anecdotes of when they would go on tour together and like somebody would call in sick or somebody wouldn't show up to the gig and he would be backstage playing the instruments for them.
Very cultish vibe with that whole scene, I think. People have trouble getting out and they're left worse for the wear sometimes.
Right, by Prince's...
emotionally. Prince himself.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. His dark charisma.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's funny that you say that he wrote all the songs, because I knew on some level when I saw the movie, I knew that to be true. But still, like two-thirds of the way through when he plays the track that the female band members gave him, mm-hmm. I was like, I don't know, man. They're really on to something.
Yeah, Wendy and like, Lisa.
As if Wendy and Lisa had written the riff, the opening riff of Purple Rain.
Right.
Not that it would be insane if the female band members had. And in fact, they did share music with each other, I found out, in the real world.
Yeah.
But it was sort of a plot device in this. But it was so funny because afterwards I was like, I don't know, I think that song the girls wrote was the best song.
Apparently he treated them like almost in real life the way he treated them in the film. Like he wasn't very nurturing and kind of dogged them out a little bit. I think he was like a tough critic, and people that were in his circle, he was even like tougher on, obviously.
Mm. So, he's a perfectionist.
Tough man to work for. Yeah, most successful crazy artists are.
They brought this up too, that he would, after gigs, he would videotape all the performances, and then he would bring the whole band back to watch the performances immediately. Like they're all trying to have a good time and celebrate. And he's like, no, we've got to watch this. And they go through the play-by-play, and he would look at every false note and just like browbeat the person who hit the wrong note.
That's like what high school football coaches do. They're like all football coaches.
Right.
Right.
But he was always striving for excellence, and that's going to make you not a very fun person to be around.
That's pretty successful, though.
Yeah.
Ultimately.
But that's how you become the greatest.
Right.
One of the most prolific artists that I've ever come across, really. When I didn't ever listen to Prince growing up, but I think I probably heard, like, listening to this album and just going through his body of work. I'm like, oh, I've heard like...
You've heard the music.
All of these songs just everywhere, you know, in roller skating rinks, mm-hmm. at King's Dominion, mm-hmm. at, Busch Gardens.
And Casey Kasem's top 40 list.
Sure, wherever I'm at.
Right.
One of these songs will come on, Raspberry Beret.
Sure.
Party Like It's 1999. When I worked at Johnny Rockets, I'd have to throw nickels at fat Americans. and they would every single one of them would at one point put like one of those nickels in the jukebox to play Party Like It's 1999.
And you had to dance to it?
Well, we were supposed to dance to it, but we were kind of a lax branch
gotcha.
Of the Johnny Rockets organization.
It's good.
So we would just side-eye people when they asked us to dance. I don't think so.
I always had a really romantic notion of Johnny Rockets because it's Hanson's favorite restaurant.
Yeah.
And
the band.
I'm a big Hanson fan.
Mm-hmm. Who isn't?
I mean, not very many people.
Mbop. Well, what did they grow? Did they grow into a more mature sound?
Oh yeah, they just did a tour where they played with a symphony orchestra.
What?
Yeah, and they wrote new music for it, and then they also rearranged some of their other songs with the orchestra, and it was really amazing. And I saw them in Minneapolis, mm-hmm. But not at First Ave. It was at a different venue. The only annoying thing was the fans were so loud and screaming and wouldn't sit down. And Hanson was like, guys, just sit down.
They were
please.
Like, this is our acoustic set. Could you?
Yeah. They're like, there's a whole orchestra here. You're embarrassing us.
Right, right. Look, the woodwinds, you can't hear the wood. Like, the strings are really trying to tune up right now. And come on. That's hilarious that Hanson has matured to a point where they're like, more mature than their fans.
Yes.
You know? Because in my mind, there'll always be 12-year-olds.
I think a lot of their fans in their minds are 12-year-olds.
Right.
Okay.
It's definitely an Arrested Development situation.
Are they all still brothers? Still?
They are still brothers.
I'm glad that
has not changed.
God. Legally brothers.
Right. You never know.
Yeah. So let's, for anybody that hasn't seen Purple Rain, this movie is a star vehicle for the one and only Prince.
Literally driven and built by one man.
And I was just so impressed by how his fingerprint is on every aspect of this movie.
Yeah.
But, you know, Prince wasn't, like I said, wasn't somebody that I was paying attention to in the 80s or even 90s ever. Yeah. And he is such a singular alien. He's like this androgynous, like lavender-wearing Dracula with dough, with like sensual dough-like eyes.
Yeah.
And in a soft voice, you know, that could be like almost compared to Michael Jackson, but with none of the sort of like childlike creepiness,
like a Final Fantasy Japanese video game character, like if Amadeus was set in space, that's what this would look like.
Those ruffles, those pirate ruffles,
ornate.
Yeah, but so he plays the kid, and the kid is the leader of a band at this club in Minneapolis, and the club can only have three house bands at a time, and one of the other bands is The Time, and then the third band is going to be Apollonia 6. Mm-hmm. So the kid is in this state of perpetual competition with The Time to keep his spot, and he's like the most experimental of the three bands, and the one that's always closest to, I guess, being kicked out for being too dramatic, too hard to work with.
That poor woman.
Yeah.
And for how hard working he was in real life, it's funny because in the movie he just kind of breezes into rehearsal hours late, doesn't do anything, and then leaves.
Right, right.
Which I guess is why he has a bad reputation at the club, even though his music is unbelievable.
But is it?
I mean,
yeah.
I was never a huge Prince fan, but ultimately, I always like respected him for some reason. I never knew why. I would never check for his music. I liked some of the hits when I was younger, obviously, but there was always something about him that I gravitated towards, like as on like a person level. Like he just seemed like, or an artist. Like he seemed completely unique. Like he invented his own style. Like you could never stick him into one category at all, or whatever the category he was in. He created it, so it's hard not to respect like unique, you know, individuality like that within like a pretty fickle and vapid business. You know, he did his own thing and did it really well.
Yeah, he was able to synthesize a lot of styles that already I think of it as like he felt like he fit into new wave, and he had like a Bowie thing going on, but he also had a Little Richard thing going on.
Oh, yeah,
and
the hair.
he was also within the funk tradition,
right?
So it was like funk that had like synth. Hard rock guitar solos.
He's an incredible guitarist
and synth.
Yep.
And so, like, that appealed to this broad swath of, like, American pop music. Because you could listen to him in a rock context, but, like, a funk context is different, or, like, a disco context. And he fit into all of that.
Right.
But he was also playing ballads.
Yeah.
And whereas, like, I personally like The Time better.
Sure.
But that's, you know, but I like The Time because they're so singularly an electro-funk band.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's, like, whenever they were on stage and they're like, oh, let's do The Bird! I, like, stood up and started, like, doing The Bird, and Amber was like, what are you doing? Like, get back into this bed and stop distracting me from the movie.
Yeah.
And I was like, I gotta do The Bird!
I mean, they looked like they were having fun, whereas he was obviously using it as, like, a personal therapy session.
Very right. Tortured.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I was thinking about, like, different themes in this movie. Like, what does it mean to be an artist? And I think we can compare, like, The Time to The Revolution. And like, who would you rather have be your band leader? Like, Morris Day or the kid, Prince, if you had to be in one of the bands?
if we're talking about longevity, because I would go with Prince, but if you want to make some hits and have fun and probably develop like a weird cocaine habit, you would go with The Time.
Yeah, like, I mean, who would be an easier boss to work with?
The guy doesn't give a shit, ultimately. Morris Day, or less of a shit.
You think so?
He was less tyrannical, and he seemed like he had a good time doing what he was doing. Yeah. But you know that that group only made like two albums, right?
The Time, they're prolific. They made at least four albums.
Did they?
Until Prince four? Stopped writing for them.
Right. Yeah, well, there you go. My choice would be Prince.
Yeah?
I think so.
What do you think? Like, I'm looking at Prince, and he's torturing his band. Like, mm-hmm. They're all like quiet children that can't talk when he's moody in
Sometimes
the room.
Sometimes you just need to be led, you know?
I think they both seem horrifying. Yeah, I mean, agreed. Prince hits his girlfriend.
Right.
And then the other guy throws a woman in a dumpster.
He has Jerome throw her in the dumpster. Okay. No, yes, they're absolutely both terrible. Like you brought up the gender dynamics in this, which kind of sound like in reading Prince's Wikipedia page, they talk a lot about how he would gave a lot of took a lot of input in from ladies who were artists.
Mm-hmm.
So he really did a lot to elevate women's careers. But then in this film, you see the way that the women are treated. And, like, is this movie problematic by today's standards? Or is it just reflecting this sort of a messier reality that exists?
I think it's problematic.
Yeah. I mean, the whole scene where he is not letting her get on the motorcycle, mm-hmm. which is sort of like played as this hilarious flirtation.
That's right. It is.
Really, I saw that and I was like, this is a major red flag, Apollonia, you know? Maybe don't even try to get on his bike. Just walk home.
Or, you know, keep your clothes on and don't jump into a river or a lake in Minnesota. She actually got hypothermia filming that scene.
I believe it.
They had to move it to LA to finish it.
And it's funny when he says that it's not Lake Minnetonka, because to someone from Minnesota, it's so obvious that that's not Lake Minnetonka, because Lake Minnetonka is enormous.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's like a tiny lake. It's probably like Cedar Lake or something.
Yeah. Yeah. So when I saw that lake and I saw his purple motorcycle, which predates him doing the Batman soundtrack, I was like, you've already got a bat cycle. Like, how is this real? And then I was wondering if Prince had a purple ski-doo that he actually used to ride on all the lakes in around Minnesota.
He had purple hubcaps, is the legend.
On his car?
Yeah.
He also loved eating at McDonald's, according to locals.
Mm-hmm.
So he would drive his purple hubcapped Cadillac.
Then get some McDonald's. Get a McDouble.
Yeah, and some McNuggets. But going back to this, like, yeah, that scene was, like, the most troubling one for me, was mm-hmm. Him, like, negging Apollonia and, like, not letting her get on the bike.
Yeah.
Or hitting her multiple times at some various points of the movie. It was made me like him a little bit less, actually, after watching this movie.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Like, I mean, he's...
'Cause I feel like that really happened a bunch of times to people. I think he wore out women, female artists that worked for him, like, mentally and emotionally, like, kind of an abusive dude.
Well, that's I don't know what happened to Vanity, but it's called Apollonia 6 because
she had to bow out.
Vanity was supposed to be the original for this movie, and she couldn't handle it.
I think in some ways he probably in every way saw himself as the star of the film of his life. So
yeah,
then he made a movie where he was the star of the film of the film, and I think that narcissism meant that everyone around him was just sort of players in his story.
Yeah.
And he created really amazing art out of that, because that's a very extreme perspective and creates a lot of confidence, but at the same time, it's destructive.
I thought of him in a lot of ways as sort of this, as an artist, I compared him to the RZA and to George Lucas. And the RZA, because he's making all of the music. And when you look at, like, the Wu-Tang Clan's first 5 years, every one of their albums is produced by him. And he took all of these individual artists and said, just give me 5 years and let me craft our image, our public image. And, you know, and that just created that sound, that Staten Island Wu-Tang sound, in the same way that Prince is creating this, like, Minneapolis sound. And then George Lucas, because, you know, when you watch a Star Wars film, like, there's all the, it's what you'd call like an immaculate reality, mm-hmm. where every detail of it feels like it belongs within that world. And when you watch, when I watch Purple Rain, I'm like, every one of these cartoon characters feels like they all fit perfectly into a Prince world.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, like they're all wearing the same type of clothes, even down to what the audience looks like. There aren't like, there's no schlub from off the street in this movie that breaks the illusion that we're in like the Purple Rain universe.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we do have to talk about the fact that the scenes are terrible. Yeah. Like, the music, I feel like we're kind of glossing past it. The music is amazing, and narratively where the songs are placed and how he performs them is so great and really elevates the whole movie.
Right.
But if you saw this with all the music performances cut out,
wow.
It would be, I don't think I would make it through.
Yeah.
I don't think I would make it through.
I mean, it was comically bad acted. The scene structure mm-hmm. made zero sense. It just mm-hmm. kept going back and forth. Like, I was genuinely confused at times watching this movie. I was like, "What?" I couldn't even tell what it was about. It was like a tale of like domestic, cyclical domestic abuse, and then like a battle of like Euro, like you know, new wave funk bands in Minneapolis. And I was like, "What the fuck is happening?"
I want to watch that. Just if you just said, "Okay, here's the pitch, Gabe."
Yeah.
All right, Booby, here we go. The movie's gonna be, it's gonna be a battle of new wave funk bands in Minneapolis. What do you say?
Like Al Pacino.
How much money do you need? I need it. I'll write you a check right now.
When the director pitched this concept initially to Warner Brothers, it was they suggested that John Travolta play the role of Prince.
Oh my wow. God. Wow. That would be a very different film.
He would have made it would have been Staying Alive.
Yeah, we saw
Midwest.
We watched a John Travolta movie recently, Staying Two Alive, which is a sequel to Saturday Night Fever, and uh-huh. man, that's another story of sort of like a megalomaniac narcissist.
That's the modern dance one, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my gosh, that movie is amazing.
Right.
My mom was watching that once, and
everyone's mom watches that movie.
Typically, her, I don't know. We didn't always line up aesthetically, right. But I remember sitting down in like junior high school and watching that with her, and just being like, wow, Mom, you're so cool. This movie's crazy. Like, just the way that it just goes all the way, and there's fog, and he's oiled up. I should have been on that episode.
Super oiled up.
Yeah.
I mean, well, speaking of oiled up, Prince as well, oiled up.
Is he?
Super oily. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not every scene, but when he sings the Nikki one.
The Nikki song.
I caught her masturbating to a magazine in a hotel lobby. I rearranged the lyrics, but you know me. You know, I'm vampire.
Very graphic, sexually. I was always shied away from Prince by any parental figure in my life or any adult. I remember he played MTV and he had that, I think it was when he changed his name to The Simple, and it was like the new Simple and the new Power Generation.
Mm-hmm.
And he cut the butt cheeks out of his pants, and everyone else on stage. My grandmother walked in. She was like, "What is this?" And I was like, "It's Prince. Do you like it?" And I was like, "No, but it's hilarious." She's like, "I don't like this music at all, but look at his butt cheeks." And I was like, 10.
That's right.
Maybe
yeah.
Older. I was like 25.
I also, though, feel like the only thing I could ever be watching that my grandma wouldn't say that would be like Matlock.
Yeah. Or like My Fair Lady.
Yeah.
Dude, my grandma would walk in. I would love it if my grandma would sit and watch a whole movie with me, but she would always, I'd say, "Hey, I'm going to put this on," and she'd go to bed. And then the moment that the most graphic, terrible scene in the movie started, she would come back downstairs for like milk and cookies. Like, I remember watching Pulp Fiction, and like the moment that they pull out the gimp,
yeah,
she's like, "Oh, I'm coming down the stairs." And, like, Bing Rames has like a choke ball in his mouth. Blah. And she's like, "Oh my God, what are you watching?" I was like, "No, you
it's out of context."
Yeah.
I mean, I guess he was known for like graphic sexuality, like obviously in his music and in general in his life, but that sex scene that where there was no sex was like the one between him and Apollonia was like that was grittier than anything you'll ever see.
Yeah.
The touching. It was very
Roger intimate. Ebert said that was one of the most erotic love scenes he'd ever seen.
Yeah, just that, because it was like he was touching when I was like, I was actually uncomfortable. I was like, that's close, man. Like, yeah. you're real close.
Right. Because yeah. he's so close.
Yeah.
He's
yeah.
on thin ice the yeah. whole time.
But it was like, I was actually like, I was like, And I was like by myself in my room, like watching this. And I was just like, This is.
Well, so yeah, this was sex ed for a lot of people watching Purple Rain. Mm-hmm. I feel like this movie, I think that watching this, I go, I see how this could be a movie that's big in the drag community. He feels like he could be an icon for trans people as well.
Yeah.
Because he is so gender fluid.
He is.
And you can watch this as like a cis hetero guy and be like, okay, like he's, you know,
he's a guy,
but he's so, I don't know, like he's playing so many, he's like soft spoken and sexy.
Yeah.
And he's got he's wearing the makeup, but he's also rocking.
He's able to play the extremes of the sexuality of both genders.
Yeah.
Which is sort of amazing because he's very kind of come hither coquette and then prancing around and then suddenly his other guitarist is doing a guitar solo, but it looks like she's going down on him and then he's doing a guitar solo.
I feel like he comes off as solidly misogynistic in general, though.
Yeah, I don't think his behavior is. Yes.
Like his character is, but I don't. Would you say his performances, like the art when you watch him on stage?
Oh, I'm just speaking as to like his personal life or what was depicted in this film. I think he comes off as like, you know.
I mean, the women, I've heard interviews with the women in his band whose names are Gabriel members.
Wendy and Lisa. Mm-hmm.
Wendy and Lisa. And they speak very highly of him. And I don't know if that's just in a public way they would feel more comfortable being positive towards him, but it sounds like he was a true collaborator, even as he was micromanaging everybody.
Oh yeah, I think micromanaging is a good word for it. Yeah, I meant like within this film, like he comes off as.
Oh yeah,
speaking
on like the Anna DeFranco called him like a queer fucking hero, and she wrote music with him when she was younger, when they were both young, like in the early 90s, and. She was pretty on board with his, you know, how he was as a person. So I feel like personal life aside, I meant personal life within the construct of the film.
I see.
Like he came off as, you know, he was like dismissive of like the female writers for the songs. He was hitting women.
Right. When we talk about the dismissive of the writers, yes, the women.
Yeah.
But his whole band.
Oh,
like,
everyone. Yeah.
He's like bullying his whole band into silence. Mm-hmm. And it made me think about, like, what does it mean to be an artist in the context of, like, I'm not saying this is right, but sort of to, like, preserve the integrity of your art, to compartmentalize all of your life. Like, he's the opposite. His character is the opposite of the collaborative art that, like, let's say we do at Story Pirates or in improv. He's like, this is my vision, and you are all... like pieces
I don't know. I mean, I see that in the character in the movie.
Right, right, right.
Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah, I think
that's the tough part about this discussion. It's so hard to, you know, split Prince himself apart from the character, which is kind of Prince in mm-hmm. the film. I mean, like it's loosely based on his life because I think he went through cycles of like his parents were divorced at 10, so he saw a lot of turmoil within the marriage and relationship, and he clearly has trust issues in the film.
Like,
yeah.
Like,
those seem pretty genuine.
One thing that I liked was like, and this is in the same scene where Apollonia is being like not let on the motorcycle.
Mm-hmm.
When he lets her on, the one thing I like is when she's like, "Will you help me?" And he goes, "No."
Yeah. He's like, "Don't join that guy," but I'm not going to help you.
Yeah, and
a little
the way I interpreted that though was, none of us can help each other in striving for excellence artistically, like. Morris Day and his band are going to go do their own thing. I'm working on myself. If I give any of myself away to help you, then I'm like compromising my own art. And your job is to like individually, you know, rise to the occasion in this like competitive environment that we've created.
I mean, I think this comes back to it.
Doesn't Morris Day take over her career anyway?
Yeah. So she ultimately like failed.
And I don't think that's uncommon in that business. I think that happens all the time. People get exploited, especially women especially during that time period.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, like, they're basically told to objectify themselves. I mean, that her dance number was basically, like, it was called Sex Shooter, which, what the fuck does that
Prince
mean?
Prince wrote Sex
right.
Shooter.
Sex Shooter.
Which is maybe the most disappointed I've ever been.
Yeah, it was basically, like, dancing around in bedroom clothing. And,
right.
Like, here, like, I'm going to get you off. That's what I'm here for.
But
that's what's happening next.
I feel like
I'm
going to
write a song about it.
Who I can't remember who it was, whether it was the club owner or whether it was Morris Day, that was like, no, we got to have somebody that's sexy, but like not trashy. It's got to be like classy.
The club owner who was fresh off of the Disorderlies at that point.
I love that guy. That club owner in his velour, like jumpsuit.
Like a Teddy Graham. A Teddy Graham and beat.
Yeah.
Yeah, he did look like a nice hug.
He looked like a solid hugger. Maybe the best hugger in the film. There was only three.
Definitely.
There were only three actual actors cast in this film, by the way.
Who were they?
I don't remember.
Oh, yeah, the dad is a legit actor.
Oh, the dad was in, like,
the
Tales
mom.
From the Hood.
Mm-hmm.
And Half-Baked, actually. The other thing is, I can't watch anything about Prince without thinking about the Chappelle Show sketch every single time. Like, that was so perfectly done that I can't even... Like,
yeah.
I wanted to watch it when I was done watching this movie. I was like, I just want to watch the sketch.
It's uncanny.
It's perfect.
How Chappelle is able to capture those Prince eyes.
Yeah. So good. Because you can tell they watched Purple Rain 1,000 times. And then they did this. Because like, they were taking lines directly. He actually quoted, you know, you need to purify yourself in the waters of Lake Minnetonka. Computer Blue. Darling Nikki, that was the name of the song.
Mm-hmm.
Darling Nikki.
So Tipper Gore heard her daughter.
Oh boy.
Tipper Al Gore's wife in 1984 heard her daughter listening to Nikki and was like, oh my God, this song is way too graphic. I need to start the parental rights advisory board for music. And I made that up. But she started like the advisory sticker warnings after listening to Prince.
And her son was smoking weed in my parents' house.
That's right. So
do a better job parenting. Parent your own kids, not everybody else's.
Al Gore Jr.
Yeah.
Yeah. But absolutely.
Damn, my last name's on this, isn't it?
It is. What a hypocrisy. And there's so many more vile sort of – there's art that's – it's funny when you see who gets attacked over censorship.
Right.
Yes.
And it's like Prince.
Prince, Two Live Crew, and NWA. Who doesn't?
There's something else going on.
What do they all have
always
in common?
Yeah.
It's not just this person that is singing explicit things.
Oh, yeah.
It's always something else. It's another thing. It's I don't understand this version of sexuality. It makes me uncomfortable. I'm afraid it's going to turn my children into...
androgynous
something
sex
that I
pirates.
Don't understand. Yeah, androgynous sex pirates. Yeah, exactly.
That's a really good way to describe what they look like.
Okay, check it out. I've got a great idea for a movie.
Space vampires.
The working title is Space Vampire Androgynous Sex Pirate. How do you feel about it?
Put John Travolta in it.
Yeah. Oh, wow. He'd be great in a leotard.
One of the production assistants, a young Lee Daniels.
What?
Yep.
That's my man. I love –
I know.
Of course.
In one of our unreleased archival episodes of the show that we'll get out there soon, we're covering a Lee Daniels movie.
Yeah, if you guys beg for it, we'll drop the Paperboy.
Or if we're busy.
Yeah.
Too busy to record. This is the last song. Like, there's an Academy Award. I have notes. The Academy Award for Best Original Musical. This was the last film to win. It actually exists, but this was the last film to win. And that was how long ago?
And then they didn't do that category anymore.
No, it still exists, but nobody's up for it, I guess. There is an Academy Award for Best Original Musical, but it hasn't been awarded for whatever reason.
Yeah.
Which doesn't make sense.
Well, I wonder if – because I feel like Purple Rain, and I might be really wrong about this, but I feel like it sort of launched the movie soundtrack as like a tie-in profit-making machine because he wrote for Batman, and then the Batman Forever soundtrack was a big deal. And then
Seal did one, right?
Yeah, he was.
Same
that
one,
was
probably.
That one.
Oh, that was that one. You're right.
Batman Forever, and then there was like the Titanic soundtrack. Even Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet. Like soundtracks were big. Were big money, and I wonder if I don't know. It's almost like he put a jukebox musical on film.
Kind of, it feels like it.
And maybe they were like, that's not fair.
But I feel like
you can't just put your album into a movie and then get an Oscar.
He was just starting to come up, I think at that time. Like, he was famous, but not extremely famous. Because we did a movie a couple of weeks ago, Risky Business, where DSMR is one of his songs. And he wasn't even credited initially for it because he wasn't big enough and they kind of wanted to screw him out of royalties or whatever. Mm-hmm. But, like, he was starting to come up and this was, like, a vehicle that was all solely him. It was, like, a star launch, basically.
Yeah, this is the thing that launched him into sort of national success or international success.
International,
he had four albums before this.
He did.
They're okay. Like, they're all
sure.
They're all okay, and they're all getting better. And I think that there was one called, like, Dirty Mind. And it was just too sexy.
Yeah.
Like, his work was
too sexy for America.
Yeah, yeah. But here, he was able to... I think as an artist, this is such a brilliant packaging of oneself.
Yes.
Because he's just making music videos.
Right.
With, like, semi-autobiographical interstitials.
Right.
And, and this movie, the script was supposed to be darker than this even.
Right.
And they were like, nah, we gotta make it, like, a little bit more antiseptic, my man.
But you also see him as a live performer, too. Yes. Which is pretty cool. I mean, that's, like, where his bread's buttered, apparently.
It's also where you see that there's a difference between the skills of performing music and acting.
Yeah.
Because when he's performing his music, he's an incredible actor.
Yeah.
He's so expressive. And
so confident.
Yeah, so confident. He goes, his vocal range, just what he can do with his voice is really insane. Yeah, but then as an actor,
he just blinks a whole bunch.
Yeah.
Great. It's like, wow, I don't think you've really had a conversation with a person.
Yeah.
Like, maybe ever.
Yeah. Like, maybe there's he's neuroatypical. Like, he's maybe a little on the spectrum in regular conversations and can't emote.
I mean, he is sort of a savant in that way.
Yeah.
Like, he's so good at this one. Well, at a huge amount of things that are part of this one medium.
Like, he was making, fully playing all the instruments for songs at 17.
Mm-hmm.
And crazy. While he was also in high school, also playing basketball.
All the sports.
Baseball, football.
Yeah.
So he's a jock.
And he's 5'2", which is crazy short.
He's a little Napoleon jock.
I mean, yeah.
Who, like, just was able to intuitively master all of these instruments.
I think both of his parents were performers. I think they were both actually musicians.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's so, right. I mean, you get those chops from somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, he's, I mean, as far as musical talent, he's up there with anybody.
And we talked a little bit about him being, you know, the domestic abuse happening in this movie, and, like, he's not, I mean, as somebody who's making a film about himself, he doesn't put himself in the best light by hitting women in the movie.
Which is,
so,
yeah.
How do we feel about that? Like, you know, did he think that everyone was just going to be okay with it, or is he trying to show?
I think that it's, I mean, and this is a really generous read on it, I think that he's grappling with the question of whether he is going to turn into his father, essentially, which I think is a big question for people with violent parents. And in that way, I think it does fit. What doesn't fit is the complete lack of consequences. Apollonia not speaking up or advocating at all for herself in that situation, or him really apologizing.
Right.
But other than that, I think it makes sense.
I thought, like, in my head to rationalize it, I was like, maybe he's showing, like, the cyclical nature of domestic violence. Like, he sees it happen, so he does it himself. Maybe he was combating that. I have honestly no idea what his real message was there, but I hope that's what that was, personally.
My takeaway was that in the way that, like, a Seinfeld TV show, that they have this rule that, like, there's no lessons at the end and no hugging,
mm-hmm.
that for this, my like, sort of ambiguous this is art takeaway was no matter how good your art is, it never fixes anything.
Right.
Mm.
So, like, he was only able to sublimate the turmoil in his personal life into something beautiful for other people to enjoy watching, like When Doves Cry. But it doesn't actually heal the thing.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, whereas, like, other movies might make this claim that, you know, well, we actually become better through art.
Yeah.
And he's like...
Like Pitch Perfect.
Right.
The moral of Pitch Perfect.
Yeah. Or, like, you know, after this one big gig, we're all going to be famous and make it. And then we'll all make up for everything that happened along the way. Where he's just kind of like, nope, you make it. And then at the end of the day, you go back and you live in your parents' basement and your dad still has a head wound. And, like... You have to go to therapy if you want to overcome, like, if you want to break these cycles.
Right.
You can't just magically do it by, like, you know, writing the best song.
Mm-hmm.
I like that it ended kind of like Staying Alive did. How you did it, kind of.
Right. Like, Tony Manero at the end of Staying Alive is still a piece of shit. He's just a really better at dancing.
Like, he worked your way up to middle management.
Oh, and this is another tie-in to Staying Alive, is that when he plays When Doves Cry in this... He hasn't rehearsed that song at all with his band. he's like, hey guys, I want to play this song that Wendy and Lisa made up.
Oh, but yeah. Purple Rain you're talking about.
Oh, that's it. Right. Yeah. Sorry, Purple Rain. Yeah.
Does Cry was a montage piece, I think, right? When he was motorcycling.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That was a montage, which allowed them to use a lot of, like, the footage for scenes that ultimately got cut.
Okay.
That they couldn't complete, so they just put that stuff in the montages.
I think he's best at his acting when he just takes Charlie Chaplin as his inspiration.
Just doesn't speak.
Right. Yeah. Just use your eyes.
Like, after he hits her multiple times, he always feels bad. You can tell that he's like, they're like, oh, I'm sorry I did that. I'm going to do it again, but I'm really sorry.
What is she doing, though? Why?
She didn't seem like a very bright person.
Apollonia, come on. Get out of there.
Yeah.
Get out of that basement.
Yeah, her character development leaves something to be decided.
Or lack thereof.
Yeah.
She just...
Roger Ebert, very taken with her. Yeah. He was like, can I be a human for a minute? I watched their review of it today, and he's like, I mean, I'm a human, right?
Yeah.
She's outstanding.
Yeah, I mean, she's easy on the eyes, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Before the film was released, Prince had, like, two nightmares involving... Ebert and what was the other guy's name?
Siskel.
Gene Siskel. He had two waking nightmares that they destroyed his film.
Oh my gosh, they loved it.
They loved it. They actually loved it. Yeah. I think it was a pretty, I mean, 84 cinema, I mean, gritty filmmaking.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
You know? They weren't telling feel-good stories. This was before things got Disneyfied.
I didn't expect this at all. I thought it was going to be like a teen pop heartthrob.
No, not even close. And I think this endeared him to a lot of people. Because I think ultimately, like, does great art come from, you know, like a backdrop of, like, pain and suffering and trauma? It seems like it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and it doesn't fix it.
Well, the funniest comedians are all broken people.
You got to go to therapy.
Right.
Go to therapy.
I guess so.
The stage won't save you.
No, it doesn't.
No.
And it doesn't save anyone around you, apparently, either. Him and Morris Day had a huge falling out during the filming of this movie.
Really?
Yeah, Morris Day had bad drug problems. They literally had to wrestle him out of his trailer to shoot scenes.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like a difficult stretch. And I think Prince doesn't forgive drug issues.
No.
Although the time played at his – sorry, I interrupted you. But
not at all.
The time played at the 1999 concert, like the New Year's concert.
Yeah. I'm sure they probably had a working relationship. That, you know, I just think they were probably good friends, and then just that dissipated after.
They were childhood friends as well.
Oh, so they're both from Minneapolis, huh?
Yeah. But I love the showmanship of the time is something that I really love, and
it's fun.
It harkens back to, like, you know, James Brown would have, like, mm-hmm. these moments where he, like, broke down on stage. And then his handlers would come and put a towel on him.
Very theatrical.
And he'd be like, okay, I'll come back one more time.
I can do it. You know? I love that.
Morris Day and Jerome have this beautiful relationship that is in all the tradition, I think, of good showmanship.
Yeah.
You know, where you've got, like, a master servant, but, like, you know, the servant's funny.
Farnsworth.
Yeah, it's Farnsworth Bentley.
Vaudeville.
The prototype.
Right. And Puff Daddy had that same character with Farnsworth mm-hmm. Bentley. And you see, and they do like a Who's On First.
They do. Little
that
riff.
Scene is, I'm going to say, bad.
It's, I love it.
Laborious. That's what I was going to say. Laborious.
It's a rough watch. Whatever. I could watch that all day. And anytime Morris Day bugs out his eyes from across the room while sipping on something.
Yeah.
Oh,
his performance is great. It's just confusing because I was like, so is he the villain? I don't understand what's happening.
Or is he a real person or a cartoon? He was like MC Scat Cat, like live action MC Scat Cat from the Paula Abdul video.
And his fashion. I loved his fashion. I loved whenever he was talking. And like
he was
Jerome
wearing like
coming.
Annie Lennox suits.
Oh, so good. And he's just getting lint picked off of him. Like, yeah. I want a hype man. I want a Jerome to be like, that's right.
Yeah.
Okay. Like, yes. Or when they look at each other, like, and they do double takes.
Yeah, it's very cartoonish.
Yeah.
I mean, there's definitely something about the contrast between those two artists in terms of, like, okay, yeah, the time shows up and they get the job done. But that guy is so boring, and Prince is so interesting.
It's true. I think that they were the comic relief to kind of take away from all the really bad acting that we were subjected to during this film.
I would watch a cartoon that follows just them going on different adventures.
I feel like it kind of just did.
Personally, I love them. I'm saying that's like the lens of the film.
Right. I got a brass waterbed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what is that?
Yeah. Who knows?
That seems like a terrible idea.
Who knows, man? He's just throwing out lines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My favorite line in the movie was, I had it down. Anyway, it was, your lips would make a lollipop too happy. Okay.
All right, Morris Day.
Sure. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, but you were talking about drugs. Because he had a hard line. He was kind of like a straight edger, allegedly, Prince, though he wasn't.
He became a Jehovah's Witness at one point, and he would actually knock on people's doors in the greater Minneapolis area and, like, talk to them about, you know. I think he was driven away from that.
Yeah, well, he needed to get a double hip replacement because he dancing with those high heels on all the time.
Oh, my gosh. And I watched another live performance of him at the American Music Awards. That's incredible. And he does, like, 6 death drops in a row.
Yeah,
like, that's the split.
Just switching sides. Like, it just goes on way long. Like, I'm not surprised that caused a double hip replacement.
He only did one in this film, but he did, like, a spin. And then that's called a death drop?
Yeah. It's a drag thing. I mean, but...
Yeah. But he... so he needed the double hip replacement, and he never got it because Jehovah's Witnesses can't do blood transfusions. Mm. So...
That was a rumor I heard around his health issues later, that he wouldn't get transfusions. They said that wasn't correct. But I don't know I don't know who's right and who's
There's
wrong.
There's a lot of mystery.
Situation. Yeah.
You know, that's the whole thing about him.
He died of an accidental fentanyl overdose. Is that what it was?
Uh-huh. Yep.
That's crazy.
Super powerful drug.
At the time, it's interesting because his friends and family said that he wasn't using anything. But his production team was lining up treatment for him in a rehab facility.
Yeah.
So it's clear that no one really knew the whole story of what was going on.
Yeah. And that's one of those drugs. That's what killed, I don't know if that's what killed Michael Jackson, but fentanyl's what's killing everybody right
what
now.
What is fentanyl? I don't know.
It's a synthetic opioid. So it's like heroin, but way stronger.
So probably crazy addictive.
So that's why there's so many overdoses, because it's just...
But there,
it's a fatal drug. It's really, really awful.
And like a tiny amount of it you can use to cut, like, you know...
Other drugs.
Right. So everyone who's... People are just ODing on it because they don't know what they're taking.
Yeah. And it's cheaper.
Yeah.
Oh, going back on the Morris Day, James Brown type feel, like Prince's first concert was a James Brown concert. So a lot of his showmanship probably came from watching James Brown and probably didn't want to be that himself, but he was like, Morris, you're going to be James Brownish.
Yeah, you're going to be the James Brown. I'll be the Little Richard. Because he's 100% taking from Little Richard, too.
Yeah, in that sense, I could see that.
Yeah.
That's an interesting... comparison.
Well, hey everybody, let's wrap this up. Let's figure out, so where do we stand on Purple Rain? Is this a movie that we would recommend to other people, or what are your final thoughts?
I would 100% recommend it. I think it's a strange but worthy collage.
Well, I loved just getting a taste of Minneapolis and that sweet, sweet Minneapolis sound. I loved all of the costumes. The live performances by Prince are riveting. And and I personally just love watching Morris Day and Jerome. So, you know, it gets two thumbs up and two platform boots from me.
I mean, I'd recommend it to people in general, but if you're not a Prince fan, I think you should watch it. Because I was never a huge fan of the music, but it's interesting to see him perform and just kind of how he is, like his life. And what's behind him.
I agree. I think it definitely will convert you if you're not a Prince fan.
It just gives you like an inkling into like what is honestly like an exceptional artist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, agree with him or not, it's he's the genuine article. So it's an interesting film. I mean, it's don't take it too seriously. Obviously, you're not going to have too much trouble doing that once Morris Day and Jerome hit the screen. But it's definitely worth watching. And the music soundtrack is incredible.
Yeah, I've been listening to the Purple Rain soundtrack all day.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, it sold millions and millions of copies worldwide.
Yeah.
One of the biggest stars in the world.
Well, Joanna, thank you so much for joining us today. Where can the people find you? What projects do you have going on? Is there anything that you'd like to plug on the show?
Oh, I'm around. You can find me on my website, joannasimmons.me.
Okay, and I got to plug Joanna Simmons. I got to plug you too, because Joanna just taught a one-man show class that was fantastic, mm-hmm. and Joanna also trained me in the ways of being a story pirate actor. So in some ways, Joanna is the RZA of the story pirates. She's created that SP sound. You're like the prince of the drama bookshop.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. High praise.
Without beating anybody. You've never beaten anybody.
You've never slapped Gabe.
Yeah.
Yeah, no.
And I've never been like, Joanna, can you help me? And have you go, no. And drive away.
No one wants to hear your acting.
Yeah, I'm best when I'm quiet. That's why I am so good at podcasts.
Yeah.
This is where Raekwon got the term onion head, by the way.
What? And
Morris,
maybe
Morris
and maybe,
Day calls him onion head. Calls yeah. somebody onion head.
And maybe the purple
Jerome.
Thing.
Oh.
Ever think about that?
Prince, influential on so
yeah.
many levels.
And I'm wearing my purple flannel today in honor of this podcast.
You sure are.
Yep. So you can find me at GabePacheco.com. Please, just, you know, if you're listening to Eat, Pray, Judge, what will really help us out is if you leave us a review. So leave us 5 stars on iTunes and then write a review for us, because that's how we get pushed up in the algorithm.
Do it.
I will be at this week. I'm at the Cape Fear Comedy Festival in Wilmington, North Carolina. And then in 2 weeks, I'll be at the Oak City Comedy Fest in Raleigh, North Carolina. So North Carolina showing me a lot of love this May, everybody.
All right.
All right. Sammy, anything?
Nope, I'm good, man. Rate, review, subscribe.
All right, great. And if you want to leave us some money, you know my Venmo. Gabriel-Pacheco. I'll split it with Sammy.
He doesn't
I promise.
Split it.
Okay. See you next time. Bye.
I wonder if anyone's ever going to do that.